From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the New York Times in March. The Times was asking teenagers in schools across the country to weigh in on a question: what is bullying like today? The responses were thorough and far-ranging. As for in-person bullying, Ava in New York said, quote, "In the hallways at high school, you hear kids yelling slurs at each other or making noises or even saying harsh comments to one another. The girls are mostly the problem in my school because they hang out in their cliques and like to pick on others because they believe that they aren't as uppity as they are. I notice that kids still harass one another for their facial features, specifically teeth, noses, forehead, eyebrows, and lips. This generation is so sad with the amount of bullying that there is on a daily basis." End quote. When it comes to cyberbullying, Bree in Georgia said, quote, "Social media has created a new wave of bullying types. The unfortunate part is that schools do not have a handle on how to regulate or provide a clear direction on how to support those who get bullied outside of school. As a result, bullying will continue because many parents will claim kids are just being kids, and schools will claim this is outside of our jurisdiction, while most students will claim, oh, it was just a joke. It becomes a sad cycle of events," end quote. And students say that they want this kind of behavior to end, and they need it to end. Mylea in New York said, quote, "Teenagers also need to make sure they are talking to an adult because many teens are depressed or suicidal. Parents also need to be more aware of their words toward their kids because some parents will bully their own children after they just experienced bullying at their own school. People need to pay more attention to what they say and how they say it because it can really hurt someone," end quote. So what does the landscape look like locally? I don't want to paint a picture that, you know, everything is the worst it's ever been or it's impossible to handle, but it is definitely more complicated than it was when I was growing up. And these are hard jobs. This is the first in a series of conversations about school safety and how schools are trying to keep kids safe. We'll talk to experts and teams across the community about how they are protecting students from physical violence, in-person bullying, cyberbullying, and more. We'll also talk about how they are monitoring perhaps digital behavior or helping students address issues pertaining to mental health and working with law enforcement. Our guests are going to talk about their work with school safety, enforcement officers, counselors, and more. Let me welcome our guests in studio now. Brandon Fox is Security Preparedness Manager for Penfield Central School District. Brandon, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Brandon Haskell is with us, Director of School Safety and Security for the Harley School. Brandon, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us is Chris Mears, the Director of Security for the Spencerport Central School District. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
And Lieutenant Keith Woodard from the Brighton Police Department. Lieutenant, thank you for being here.
Evan, I appreciate it.
I was just talking before the program began with our guests about how much has changed. And Lieutenant's been on the force for well over a decade, about 14 years, I think you said. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And I was just asking you how much has changed in regards to school safety and the work that you might be doing in that sphere. And you said even in 14 years, quite a lot.
Yeah, it's a world of difference, that's for sure.
What would you say is the biggest change?
I think a lot of it is the online connection that kids constantly have now, right? So the constant connection to other kids, and you brought it up. Times are much different than you and I when we went through school. And those conflicts continue, and those conflicts continue and carry on from school outside, and then sometimes, unfortunately, involve law enforcement.
Well, listeners, if you want to share your thoughts this hour, you can do that. You can call the program toll-free. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. It's 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@wxxi.org. You can find us on a whole lot of platforms, and we'll try to work in some of your feedback this hour. Let me start by just kind of going around the table and asking our guests from school districts where they want to start this question on safety and some of the work they're doing. And it starts with just a question that I have, and I'll start with Brandon Fox. Are you seeing an increase in either violence or threats or bullying in your district? Would you put it that way?
No, I don't think I would see an increase. I think we've seen an increase in violence nationwide, but I wouldn't say in our school specifically.
Okay, so can you describe some of the work that you do generally, and then we're going to get into threat assessment, physical safety in school districts. But can you describe some of the work that you do and how you describe the mission of your work?
Sure. The two pieces that you just described there are the biggest chunks of what I do. Looking at our schools as far as what we're doing for our physical security. And then I oversee our threat assessment team, which we call our behavioral intervention team for the district.
Okay. And how long have you been with the district?
This is my 22nd year.
22nd year. Brandon Haskell at the Harley School. You've been with the Harley School for how long?
11 years.
11 years. Are you seeing any increase in threats, violence, bullying, et cetera?
Like Brandon Fox, I'd say not an increase. I think things are pretty steady. And also like Brandon, I'm covering both the physical safety and security side as well as leading threat assessment efforts.
Okay. And that work has gotten more complicated, or is it after 11 years, do you feel like you're in a pretty good rhythm with it? You've got a job I would never want, I would say, Brandon. So I just respect what you do. But how would you describe the challenge of the work?
It's definitely challenging, but I think we have some really good tools available to us right now, including like the threat assessment process and training that goes along with that to help us, look at those issues and try and intervene where possible. So those are really good for us to have and to utilize.
Chris, how long have you been with Spencerport?
I've been with Spencerport about 2.5 years, and I was in law enforcement for 28 years before that.
Okay, so what are you seeing in Spencerport?
Actually, I would say the number of our violent altercations has decreased over the last two and a half years. I would mostly attribute that to, I think, students getting back to being used to being in the classroom full time. Nobody wants to go back to talk about COVID, but I think COVID really hurt students emotionally.
Social development.
Yeah. And ability to interact with other people, I think, was seriously affected. So the first year, year and a half, when students came back into the classroom full time, we had some serious challenges. And those are starting to work themselves out as we get used to talking to each other again face to face.
All right, let me ask those from the districts what your districts are doing. And maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the changes that have come down since the summer from the Department of Ed in New York State about active shooter drills. That is not a phrase I would have ever heard growing up. And a lot of kids are familiar with it, but not every school is doing it the same. So Chris Mears out in Spencerport, do you do active shooter drills?
We do lockdown drills.
Lockdown drills.
We have not done an actual active shooter drill with reenactments and the fake blood and the fake gunshots and all that goes with that. But we do regular lockdown drills just as a matter of course. It's required by the State Education Department. So we make sure that we comply with the orders from the State Education Department to make sure that if an active shooter event actually did occur, that our students are and staff were ready to respond to that.
And the state made some changes this past year about
correct,
that?
Right.
What are the changes?
So basically the changes state that if we were to do an active shooter drill with those details that I mentioned before with the simulated gunshots. Right.
Yeah.
We actually have to have written permission now from parents or guardians to have students take part in that drill. So it really adds another level to us having to do a drill like that. I don't foresee something like that happening unless it was a large-scale exercise with numerous police departments and several school districts involved. It is a big undertaking anyway, and I think really the state was trying to minimize that the trauma to the students for a drill like that.
Trying to be responsible as we talk about this. So I want listeners to understand what Chris just described, simulated gunshots, even simulated blood, things like that. That is not, as far as I know, all that common in schools. It is also not totally unheard of. I mean, there have been very realistic active shooter drills in certain places around the country. Doesn't mean that it's happened in your district. And maybe you've got different views on that. Chris, for you, is it unnecessary? Is that too much? What do you think of that?
I see the value in it as long as everybody's aware of what's going on well ahead of time. Obviously, we want folks to be aware well ahead of the drill, of an exercise of that type. It would not be something that would happen during the school day out of the blue unannounced. I think that would be something probably during the summer where we would bring people in, coordinate with area first responders and do an exercise of that type. It's a pretty large scale event to try to organize and conduct.
And that's not something that's currently planned in Spencerport, is that right?
I won't say that we're not planning for it. I think we're working toward it, but you have to take baby steps. You start with tabletop exercises and conversations. You move to a smaller exercise, and then maybe, again, with everybody's consent and awareness, move to that type of thing sometime in the future. It does have value. You really can't gauge your community's readiness until you test it, until you drill it. So it does have value, but we just need to make sure that everybody's on the same page.
Sure. And again, with the rules, parents would have to consent. Kids would only be involved if there was a thumbs up from that household.
Correct.
How young could kids be for this?
Oh, I wouldn't want to do this with anything younger than high school age students. I think it is traumatic even for adults to take place in take part in a drill like this. So I would want to make sure that nobody younger than high school age would take part.
And you've heard some of the critics who say that this is so far over the line that kids could be mentally messed up going to school on a regular basis. And as much as school shootings continue to be a problem, it's still, I mean, if you want to just do the math, your child is not likely to be involved in a school shooting, thank God. Doesn't mean that they don't happen. I'm not minimizing where they have happened, but I don't want people to think every other school is going to end up with a shooter by the time your kid graduates high school. That is not at all what the math is. So what do you say to the critics who think, you know, that's too much for kids? Like, you're going to make them scared to be in a classroom.
There is some validity to that. I would agree to that to some point. If you have students who are willing to take part, who are interested maybe in law enforcement or in government service or public service or something of that nature, and they want to actively take part, I don't see the harm in having them help out on a summer day when there's nobody else in the school.
Brandon Fox at Penfield, do you do active shooter or lockdown drills?
Just lockdown drills.
Just lockdown. Have you done any active shooter in the past? Is that something that was considered?
Not with students and staff. When the Monroe County Sheriff's Office was first rolling out how to get into schools and have first responders follow them that would be needed for medical purposes, we did host them one summer so that they could work on new training and also get to know our schools. But we've never come close to the idea of involving our students.
Okay, and why not?
I think the muscle memory of the lockdown drills would be sufficient for them to get into the right place at the right time. Now, it'd be much different for our law enforcement partners to have to learn how to deal with the stress that would be involved in that situation. But for our students, like you said, between the math and what we need them to do in that situation, getting to the right spot in the classroom or getting behind a locked door is the priority, and we can do that through a lockdown drill.
Do you think that the changes that came from New York State make sense in that you can't just do this now at that level, that simulated shooter drill? You have to get permission to do anything like that. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And do parents ask about this? Is this something that comes up with parents in your district?
Rarely. It came up a little bit more this year because one of the other parts that the state put in place is we also have to give them notice that we're going to be running a drill, whether it's an evacuation drill or a lockdown drill. We have to put a notice out there. So that was a change to what they were used to. So there was some questions that came from there.
Okay. And Brandon Haskell at Harley, what do you guys do?
We just do lockdown drills.
Okay. And did you consider at any point active shooter?
We have not at this time.
What do you think the response would be among your school community for that?
It would not be well received, I don't think.
Okay.
But like Brandon and Chris both said, we focus a lot on the procedural part of a lockdown and drill that over and over again so it becomes a muscle memory. So if an event were to occur, people know exactly what to do. So we try to focus on those elements.
Do you think, Brandon, that students and the school community understand that no one wants to have to do a lockdown drill? No one ever wants to be in a lockdown. But we're doing this for a reason, and we're not going to scar kids. That they understand it may be unlikely, but it's good knowledge to have. Do you feel like that is generally the disposition?
Yeah, and especially over the last 2 years, as we really kind of honed in on our emergency procedures, was a lot of the explanation behind the why we're doing it and why we're taking the time to do this. And that caused a big attitude shift, at least in my perspective at Harley, from everybody from doing those.
Lieutenant Woodard, does the Brighton Police Department have any position on active shooter drills?
As far as
do you want to see schools do them? What are you communicating about that with them? Anything?
I think it's very important to continue the lockdown drills. We haven't, you know, dived into the active shooter drills necessarily with, especially not with any of the public high schools or anything like that. We've had vast active shooter training amongst the law enforcement side, And I think Brandon said it best, though. It's to start with the why we're doing these things, why the schools are doing them. And that's what's important, to lead with that so people understand why this is important.
Do you think people get it?
I hope they do.
Okay.
I hope they do.
Reading through the New York Times coverage of the new rules, New York schools, public and non-public, would be required to conduct 8 evacuation drills. That's different than a lockdown. So four lockdown drills, 8 evacuation drills a year. Is that right? Okay. My concern is students start to think that every drill is just another one of those roll your eyes, you know, fire alarm drills, and that they would be able to take it seriously. But Chris, you nodded right away, but you think that the school can get into place pretty quickly if they knew it was the real thing?
I do. When you look at why we do evacuation drills, generally, you know, people associate those with fire drills. When there hasn't been a public school death due to a fire since 1952, but we continue to do 8 of those a year. When you look at the number of unfortunate fatalities that we suffer in schools due to active shooters, and we do half that number of lockdown drills, I think we need to you know, kind of maybe change our emphasis a little bit. But students, I think the students take it very seriously. They see what's happening in schools across the country. They don't see it as a joke. Honestly, you know, making sure that staff is doing the right thing during these drills can sometimes be more of a challenge than dealing with making sure the students are doing the right thing.
I mean, that's so interesting. Brendan Haskell, you agree? You think your students understand what's up around the country and that they take it seriously?
Yeah, I think some more than faculty and staff do. And we kind of get, you know, some students who are very nervous or feel, you know, some kind of trauma from an event that they've heard about. Nothing that's actually taking place at the school. And so, you know, our counselors kind of work with them on that. But I think a lot of the kids really, really, truly understand why we're doing this, especially lockdowns.
Brandon Fox?
Yeah, especially, you know, if you get word that someone's not taking it seriously and you invite them in for a conversation. We changed a drill we did a couple of years ago where a student had a concern that, you know, what happens if it's during passing time and kids are in between classes. Mm-hmm. So we ran a lockdown drill during passing time just from the student feedback. So I think if you can engage the students and get their feedback and buy-in, I think that helps everyone buy into how to do it correctly.
We're talking about school safety. Obviously, the physical safety, and it can intersect with bullying, online bullying, et cetera. And there are some questions that we're going to be kind of working through there with our guests from the Penfield Central School District, Spencerport, the Harley School, and from the Brighton Police Department. It's the first in our series of conversations that are to come about changes in school security and what individual schools are deciding to do about that. One of the questions becomes physically, what do you do with your building? Do you have weapons detection? Do you have different entry points or a single entry point that is kind of multiple doors, guarded, etc.? And has that changed over the years? So, Brandon, can you take us through how people sort of get in and out of the buildings, if that has changed, and if you've decided to do weapons detection?
Yeah, I can get into the entry point because that's something that we've put a large priority on.
Okay, and we're talking Penfield here. Go ahead.
We have changed our schools over the years since, you know, when I first started, to where students could enter in multiple points, to where we have a single point of entry for our buildings. That allows us to put staff at the entry point that can recognize students coming in, kind of get a hold of anybody that they might have a concern about as they come in. It also helps us spread our adults out to the areas of the building that we know where students generally gather together, so we can spread those resources and keep an eye on our kiddos.
Okay. Brandon Haskell at the Harley School.
I'd say Harley has gone through a major transformation over the last, you know, 11 years that I've been there, from doors never being locked to now a single point of entry after morning drop-off. So we have a secure vestibule. You have the buzz to get in. Like Brandon at Penfield, we have people greeting students as they come in the building in the morning, starting from the parking lot all the way inside of the building. There's somebody that they're going to cross by who's going to say hello to them and, you know, make sure that they're somebody who should be entering the school.
Okay. And Chris Mears at Spencerport?
Spencerport has put a lot of money into secured vestibules this past year and the next coming years. We are moving towards every building having that secure vestibule so that there are 2 sets of locked doors between the exterior of the building and the students on the inside. So that's kind of how schools are being built now, with that secure vestibule plan. We're moving towards that, and definitely single point of entry is vital to keeping your students safe during the day.
To state the obvious, what we're really talking about here is if a shooter was trying to get into the building, it would be a lot more difficult. They would have to go, I mean, unless they found a way in somehow with force, another point, they couldn't open a door and get in. They'd have to go in through one entry point and maybe with multiple layers there.
Right. That first entry door allows you to speak to our greeter, and then there's a second entry door before you have access to the inside of the building.
Okay. Again, Lieutenant, do you advise on any of this stuff, or is this up to individual schools?
No, I think it's an excellent idea. I think every school should be mandated to have such policies. Again, you can't even build a building anymore up to fire code without fire doors and everything else. And like Chris said, we're pushing a century of no kids dying in any school fires. So again, this is paramount, I think, for security.
Yeah. So let me get a piece of feedback that I think is interesting. Joseph says you're talking a lot about physical safety, but the reason that there are school shootings is we have a mental health crisis and a bullying crisis. So that's from Joseph. Thank you for that email, Joseph. I'll let all of our guests respond on that point. And I don't seek to create any kind of an image that, well, it's all about one thing, or it's all just about whether there's metal detectors, or it's all about whether there's a single entry point. But I take your point, Joseph. The crushingly tragic part of this is that schools could be targeted at all, and that someone would be so determined to get in that they would try to get through a single entry point or find a way in. And why is that happening? So Brandon Fox at Penfield. Mm-hmm. Brandon's the security preparedness manager for Penfield. Joseph wants to focus on why these things happen. And I think the question of threat assessment has got to be so difficult because kids say flippant things.
Mm-hmm.
Kids sometimes make threats they would never follow through on. Kids are aware of what is going to get attention or shrill. And yet, I would not want to be in your position of having to, someone comes to you and says, hey, look at this. This person made this comment on social, or this looks like a threat. How do you, can you take me through what that is like and how you would address what looks like threats versus
sure.
So maybe just idle chatter?
You have to take a deep dive into each one that comes in. And what we've learned from the Secret Service and the FBI is that there are behaviors that we should be looking for. There's a term we'll probably get into today called the pathway to violence. So as you're looking at these threats, you're trying to find out, was it somebody just trying to be funny? It could be somebody trying to be funny but bullying at the same time. As far as violence is concerned, you're looking for behaviors within that threat. You're looking, in order to do that, you need to get a big picture of the students. So you're going to have to talk to the students' teachers. You're going to have to take a look at internet history. You're going to have to take a look at their socials so that you can start to build as much information about that student or adult, whoever it is that you're taking a look at, so that you can get an idea of where they are at and get an idea of the seriousness of that threat.
How often are you doing that kind of work?
Probably weekly.
Yeah. And does most of it amount to this person is not a physical threat, but we need to curtail some of the communication or the behavior? Or have you had situations where it's crossed over that to you think there's a physical threat?
I would say a large majority of it, according to the Virginia study, it's going to be usually about 70%. But I find it to be even a larger number, is going to be something where someone's probably upset with another person, or they may have jokingly offended another person, which can be a problem as well that has to be addressed. Does it cross that threshold of a threat that we have to take a look at where someone is getting down that pathway? That is extremely rare.
Okay. And then the intervention is working to... What kind of intervention, I guess, with a student who is either bullying or making even threats that you don't think are actually serious but are a problem?
If there's a lot of layers in that question. So if there's a conflict between two people, mm-hmm. Getting that conflict worked out. You know, a lot of us are working on relationships at schools and looking at different ways that we can get students back to where before they offended one another or got to a bad place. If someone is looking a little bit more serious and they're looking like they might create violence, we need to look at some mitigating factors, right? We need to look to see if that home needs some additional support. We need to look to see if there are things in the school programming that we can put into place that maybe will put that student in a better place. We got to take a look at a big picture and all the options on the table.
Okay. Let me ask the same question of Chris Mears out in Spencerport. We'll stay in public schools for the moment here. How do you handle threat assessment? How often are you dealing with that?
I'd say, you know, weekly to daily. It depends on the time of the day or time of the year. We at the high school meet once a week at least to discuss students who their behavior can be concerning. And then again, the reason that we continue to look, we continue to support, and we continue to assess. So assessment is a big piece of the threat assessment process. It's right in the name. So as we continue to assess, we measure those mitigating factors that Brandon mentioned, and we provide those mitigating factors. If we have to, we basically bubble wrap that student with all the support and services that we can muster. We try to do that deep dive. That's why we do it as a team, not as an individual, so that we're looking at it from as a multidisciplinary approach, mm-hmm. not just from the security aspect, not just from the teacher aspect, not just from the counselor aspect. Add the administrators, add the teachers that know the student very well, just to see where that student is and what that student needs. So, I mean, we could go 2 or 3 weeks without having to do a threat assessment, and then we might have 2 or 3 in a day. It's that type of business.
Okay. And, you know, Chris, as you said, you've been in law enforcement before you were in school safety. And you've probably over time heard some of the critics who would say, hey, you talk about wrapping kids in support and services, but don't criminalize them. Like, understand that a lot of them who would be in this situation may be coming from a rough circumstance, or there may be other mitigating factors. And if you quote unquote criminalize them, that could cement a path for them. And I wonder how you feel about that argument.
The goal of threat assessment is to get that person off the pathway to violence. It is not necessarily to lock a person up or put them away. We need to get that person what they need. Otherwise, whatever grievance they have that has caused this caused them to be on this pathway to violence will continue to fester and continue to grow to the point where they might actually commit violence. So that's not our goal. Our goal is not to lock people up or put people away. We want to get the people the help they need so that they can get off the pathway to violence, and certainly in the education field, to get them back in the classrooms and learn.
You've got Lieutenant Keith Woodard from the Brighton Police Department right next to you nodding. You want to add to some of that? What do you think?
Yeah, I completely agree with Chris. The goal of law enforcement is certainly not to lock kids up. It's to get them on that pathway to making good decisions and having great relationships. And a part of that with the threat assessment team and with adding law enforcement into that, I'm not naive. I understand what people's perception is of that. It's changed. Law enforcement's changed drastically, especially in the last 5 years even. We have been very good at coming in and handling situations historically, but that's not the goal of these threat assessments and the inclusion of law enforcement in them. It's a collaborative effort. We're there to offer resources, give guidance, and, you know, unfortunately, sometimes, yes, the other aspect is necessary, but that is definitely not the overwhelming goal.
If we get there, it sounds like something has gone pretty far.
I would agree.
Okay. Brandon Haskell at Harley, how do you handle threat assessment?
Well, thankfully, ours are pretty sparse when something does come up. Most of the time, it's just something transient, and we can, you know, settle it pretty quickly. If something substantive does come up, you know, we have a good benefit for Harley is that we are small, so we have a tight community, so we have some really good counselors, and every upper school student has an advisor assigned to them, so we can bring people together pretty quickly to step in and look at the situation and provide more information, especially what mitigating factors are. So if we have a student who we're concerned about, we can find out, you know, what are they at Harley for, what do they enjoy doing, how can we help further support that to ensure that they're not getting on a pathway to violence for anything.
How's your relationship with law enforcement?
Great.
Look right across the table there.
Yeah. That was one of my chief priorities, you know, starting 2 years ago, was to build our relationship with Brighton PD. And I think that's worked out pretty well.
You agree with that, Lieutenant?
Absolutely. Brandon's done a great job.
So Listeners, what we're going to do after we take our only break of the hour here is I want to hear how Brandon Fox from Penfield would maybe further that conversation on what a pathway to violence actually looks like. I want to make sure we understand that term as a community. And I've got some more feedback from you. I've got listeners who've got pretty strong views on cell phones in schools. I knew that that would be coming. I know there are a lot of debates about that and the effects they can have. And I also, I want to say to Joseph, who sent the email, we're going to talk a little bit more in our second half hour about how we get to a healthier place where these threats, et cetera, aren't happening. I mean, I'm in Gen X. I think there, I was naive for a number of years thinking, you know, Gen Z, Gen Alpha, like they get why bullying is terrible. It's not going to happen. It's going to be much less. But now there are all these tools that didn't exist when I was growing up. And it, there's any little dispute can become instant and aggressive in ways that didn't exist before. You used to be able to leave school and then you're in the backyard or you're going down the street with friends and you're kind of in a new your own world. And now you can't get away from it. And it's tough. So our guests are doing hard work. They understand people have different views on safety and what their roles should be. But we're glad that they are here, and we'll take some more of your feedback after we take this only break. Coming up in our second hour, ranked choice voting, open primaries. Those issues did very poorly when voters had them on their ballots this year. So why is that? A good government group is joining us next hour. They believe they've got some common ground, some bipartisan ideas to make government better or make the election system better. So how come it didn't fare very well at the ballot this year? We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking about school safety. A lot has changed. If you grew up primarily in the 80s, 90s, like I did, it's a different deal now. And it's kids can get a hold of each other in ways that they could not before. And from threat assessment to physical building safety to what you do with social media taunts, et cetera, we're just trying to work through how schools are dealing with it, what the law says they can and can't do, what the state says they can and can't do, and what you think they should do. It's 844-295-TALK if you want to call the program. It's 844-295-8255. Or if you want to email us, I'll get back to your emails in just a second, connections@wxxi.org. Brandon Fox from Penfield, you mentioned this term, pathway to violence, and your colleagues use that term. I want to ask you how you define it and what you want the community to understand about it.
Certainly. So it's a concept that came up, I believe it was developed in the 80s between Secret Service and some other folks. But when we look at those who have gone on to commit this targeted violence, what they can clearly see is this pathway. And it typically starts with a grievance that the person can't get past. Like you or I, you and I can get past a grievance and move on with the rest of our life. These folks unfortunately cannot. From there, they start to move on to ideation, where they start to believe that violence is the only means to an end of their grievance. From there, we see them moving to research and planning. They start to figure out how they can be most effective in this targeted violence. The methods that they'll need, the weapons that they'll need, how the whole procedure will happen. Likely then the subjects move to preparation, where they start to practice. Sometimes they will begin to costume and start to look a certain way that they want to prepare for that event. You're getting pretty late in this pathway, by the way. This is a really dangerous time. After preparation, we typically see breach. There's not much time between when a person reaches breach and the actual violence is going to happen. Breach typically is described when a person starts to probe the target. Because when we talk about targeted violence, a person is choosing the target as their opportunity for violence instead of choosing a specific person to go after. And then after they're through with this breach area, they go on to commit their attack.
Let me address a couple of questions listeners have. So Mark wrote in to say that it's not always a personal grievance that a person will have. He references the Pennsylvania shooter who tried to assassinate President Trump this summer, who by all appearances wasn't an overtly political actor. He had Googled when the Democratic National Convention was. He was clearly troubled and wanted to do something horrific, kind of blaze of glory type stuff that should trouble all of us. I have no idea why he was able to get as close. I mean, I haven't read a lot of the detail. I wonder whether it is a case like that or whether it is, again, God forbid, another school mass shooting, do you then, Brandon, do you sort of spend some time reading and analyzing and trying to learn from events that happen elsewhere and just try to understand some of the steps that put someone down that road?
Yeah, absolutely. But one of the things that I will try very hard to do is make sure that the information that I'm learning from is correct. And a lot of times that takes months, if not years, to get the accurate information. If we try to learn from the information that comes out in the first couple weeks, even months, a lot of that can be inaccurate and lead us in a bad direction. So court papers and that kind of things, we usually wait to learn from.
Brandon Haskell, do you find yourself studying other events that happen elsewhere?
So Chris and I just talked about this recently, actually, that sometimes we both find ourselves like sitting in our office and combing through details from other school shootings to try and learn, you know, what signs were missed that should have been obvious to if there was a threat assessment team there, or how did they, you know, carry it out, what the timeline for things was, just to kind of learn maybe how to shore up our own defenses for our own schools.
I mean, I guess it's an important part of the work, Chris. You want to add to that?
Doesn't always make you popular with your IT people when you're searching these things at work, but unfortunately, it is a part of the job. I try to do that for our folks at Spencerport, put together case studies, and again, not trying to make others look bad, just trying to learn from what we see so that we can shore up our defenses, so that we can maybe not miss the same things if they do come down our pike, just to raise awareness.
Yeah. Do you do the same thing, Lieutenant?
Yeah, absolutely. But I'd like to say Mark is right. It doesn't have to be a personal grievance. It's, you know, it can be a perceived grievance. It doesn't even have to be based in reality.
Mm. Unfortunately, often it is based on a distorted view of reality.
Yeah, they take many forms. The grievances take many forms, and it can be just that desire for notoriety.
Yeah.
It can be an ideological grievance. It can be as simple as just being offended and not being able to get over it. The bullying. A bullying can be the start of a serious and actable grievance.
So CY writes to the program to say, after you've dealt with an immediate threat on a given day, how do you follow up with making sure the primary individual, as well as those around them, have the support over weeks or months or even years? What sort of long-term support services do they give? And how do they figure out how to solve the problem? You know, he wants to know, is it step by step? Is it student by student? I mean, every case is different, of course, Chris Mears over at Spencerport, but how would you describe the process that goes beyond, okay, today we had a threat assessment, we had to deal with an individual issue directly, but then going forward, what are you doing with that?
Management is the most important piece. You can investigate a threat, you can assess a threat, but if you don't manage it properly, then everything you've done up to that point is kind of worthless. So management is huge, and I mentioned that sometimes we meet weekly. Well, we meet weekly at the high school, not necessarily to discuss new threats, but to assess and manage threats or concerning behaviors that we've seen from students in the past. So once we have assessed and determined a person has a grievance, we work very hard to make sure that grievance doesn't pop back up again. There isn't a new grievance. And that student is receiving the care and support that they might need. So management can go all the way through a student's educational career and beyond. I mean, we even have to look, if you look at what happened in Nashville, you have to look now beyond the end of the school relationship with some of these folks to make sure that they don't continue carrying that grievance and then act on it. It's a long-term relationship.
Brandon Fox, can you weigh in on that too? And I wonder over time if that has changed or expanded the kind of approach to dealing with this kind of a threat.
Absolutely. So a lot of the information that we use now, I would say, is relatively new to schools. When this information was first being released, I would say the threat assessment part was sort of the priority. But in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, this management side, we have a better understanding of. And once you're doing it, you can really see the importance of it. A lot can happen to an individual over a week or 2 weeks' time. And to have the ability to talk about them with other people in your school district to get those different perspectives can make all the difference in the world.
And Brandon Haskell at Harley?
Yeah, we do the same thing. We have a lot of follow-up meetings. We're actually starting up monthly meetings with our team and anybody who's relevant to the case we have at hand, just to keep a bunch of eyes on it and just track and see how they're doing.
I also want to ask what some listeners have asked about when it comes to cell phones. And I want to say that this is a really, it's a separate conversation for a separate day that we will have with superintendents, teachers. We're going to talk about how they feel about cell phones in the classroom or even in the school building. And I will reference, before I let our guests weigh in on this, there are some experts in psychology, people like Jonathan Haidt, who was a co-author of The Coddling of the American Mind. A lot of his work now is trying to convince schools just to say, no cell phones, period. Not, hey, can't use them during class or put them in a locker. Don't have, because he said in between classes, Jonathan Haidt said there's research that indicates students are checking messages and they're following up with stuff and they're distracted because they know that there's something on their phone that they want to go see. And they'll do it at lunch and they'll do it, you know, they'll go to the restroom and they'll try to sneak over and do it. And he says, just get them out of there. They don't have enough of a benefit and they have all kinds of potential harm to the educational process, to focus, to say nothing of bullying and sort of the really toxified social media and relationships. So I wonder how you feel about that, Chris. I mean, I try to tell kids these days, like, I did grow up without a cell phone. It's amazing. We did it.
We somehow did it.
But is it a safer school community without those for kids?
My opinion, yes.
You do think so?
So Spencer Port has adopted, there's a spectrum, right? One end of the spectrum, no control. The other end of the spectrum, no cell phones in school at all, right? So we're probably on that spectrum 1 to 10, we're probably like a 7.5, maybe an 8, where students are allowed, high school students are allowed to have their cell phones with them during the day, during passing time, and during lunch, sometimes during study halls. But when you enter a classroom, you place your cell phone in a pouch by the door, and it's not accessible to you during the class unless your teacher sees it as a necessary tool for the education for that class. It has actually cut down, I would say, on problems during class immensely. It has cut down on our issues. There are some students that occasionally don't want to give up their phones for the reasons you mentioned, because they're afraid, it's that fear of missing out. They're going to miss something for that 45 minutes to an hour. And that becomes a consequence issue with administration. But I would say overall, it has cut down on our cyberbullying. It has cut down on our meetups for whatever purpose during the day that isn't beneficial to education. It has cut down on that in a big way.
I want to ask you what parents say, and I want to
say the pushback.
I want to say this. Like, what's really interesting about this? The first time I really kind of was aware that I was looking at the wrong place sometimes with this issue was talking about summer camps. So we were talking 7 or 8 years ago about summer camps who wanted to say, hey, if you're coming to our camp, like no phones, like YMCA camps, overnight camps. And they said the campers, back and forth on it. But they said it was the parents who were like, I have to be able to get a hold of them. Like,
right.
And I want to say, like, if you're a listener and you're in that category who thinks that your kid does need that phone for that reason, like, all the love to you. I'm not trying to judge. But like a whole lifetimes upon lifetimes existed in which that didn't happen. And so it's a trade-off. And I don't know that we need in the middle of summer camp or in the middle of algebra to be able to get a hold of a kid. Maybe I'm wrong here. So is the pushback from the parents even more than the kids?
There was some pushback from parents, definitely. They want to know where their kids are. They want their students to be accessible. And I hate to say it, but if there was an incident at the school, want to know their kid is okay.
That's
they want
right.
to get that text message saying, I'm okay, I'm whatever. Hey, I get it. I had kids in Spencer Port schools. Nothing bad ever happened to them, and nothing bad ever happened to me. And I made it all the way through somehow 13 years of education. I didn't have to do any of them a second time, so it was only 13. But I made it all the way through without a cell phone. And like you're saying, I really think it just cuts down on the distraction and the that fear of missing out if it's just not there.
What about at Penfield, Brandon Fox, Security Preparedness Manager? What's the cell phone policy over there?
Similar to Spencer Port, the teachers will often have the students put the cell phones in a pouch or ask them to put them away. So we're pretty similar to where Spencer Port is. I do think there's an advantage to having students be able to unplug. It's funny that you mentioned the camps because some of the kids that I work with. I also coach in the district, you know, and a couple of them have gone to those camps. And when they come back, they'll admit that it feels pretty good to unplug for whatever that camp was, a week or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yes, of course. Okay. But do you anticipate problems with parents going forward if you get even stricter?
Oh, if we got stricter, yeah, there'd be some pushback. There'd have to be a lot of community engagement. We'd have to have a lot of committees and have, you know, parents give voice, and that would have to be a big discussion.
Well, here's what a parent might say. They might say, Brandon, the reason you're on public radio today is because we have to be concerned with school violence, school mass shootings, and you're going to take my kid's cell phone away during an event like that? I mean, I do understand the visceral emotion of that, mm-hmm. and I know you do too. I'm just trying to weigh things out here. But I think that that's going to be a hard barrier for you and your job, convincing parents.
Yeah, that would be a hard barrier. I'll be honest with you. I don't know which way that would go.
Yeah. Brandon Haskell over at Harley, what's the cell phone policy?
I think we're all in the same boat with our handling cell phones this year. In terms of parent pushback, one of the things that I focus a lot on is gaining trust through communication with parents ahead of time. So I see a value in students not having phones on them in an emergency, because you know they're going to be constantly wanting to contact their parents and overload them with communication that might not align with what we need to do as a school to respond. So getting parents to trust in our ability to respond before something happens is a big thing for me. So communicating with them what our procedures are, you know, how things will work, how they'll be contacted if something comes up is really important. And I think they really appreciate that.
Charles writes to say, Evan, I've taught for 33 years, and after the debacle of COVID and closed schools, the climate was night and day. After we all returned, the number of incidents absolutely skyrocketed. Kids would break down crying in the middle of class. Bullying increased. Fights were breaking out. Trauma, trauma, trauma. We can argue the reasons forever, but the truth is things changed for the worse. As teachers, counselors, and administrators, we are overwhelmed with troubled kids right now. That's from Charles. I think there is some general agreement that COVID did. It inhibited social development, those skills that are vital. At really tough times, especially if your kid is in middle school, elementary school, going to middle school, high school. But are we getting past that? I mean, Chris, would you say it's getting better now?
I think it is.
Do you still see some of those effects?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely. There are a lot of hurting kids out there. There are a lot of kids who still can't open up and tell us what they need. There are a lot of kids out there who aren't getting what they need and don't have anybody with eyes on them. During COVID, when kids were home, most of the time, parents had eyes on them. Now they've come back to school. We have to build some of those relationships back. We really have to make these connections with students. You know, we make sure that when we're looking at a student during maybe a threat assessment or if we've seen some concerning behavior, who is the adult in the building that student is comfortable talking to? And if we can't identify that, then we make sure we send somebody to make that connection. So I think before COVID, I think more students had these connections, and they lost them during COVID.
Brandon Haskell at Harley, what are you seeing there?
Again, I think we're probably all going to be aligned on this. Definitely some improvement, but definitely things to pay attention to still. Kids out there still need, you know, assistance. You know, one of the first things we do if something pops up is, you know, all the counselors are all on a threat assessment team, so immediately checking in with them. Is this a student we've already been looking at that is currently seeking help or needs help? And to kind of expedite the process.
Penfield?
Yeah, definite improvements. I don't know if this is true or not, but my observation, it seems like the older students are recovering faster, and some of the younger students are still, you're still seeing a little bit of those signs of struggling to be in the class.
Listeners, as we get ready to wrap here, some were asking, you know, you're going to talk to districts like RCSD, others? Absolutely. I mean, this is the first in a series of conversations, and those conversations will happen. But Lieutenant Woodard from the Brighton Police Department, do you feel like the changes that we've talked about this hour that you've seen over 14 years, but really that have happened even in the last 3 to 5, do you feel pretty comfortable that schools are a pretty safe place for kids now?
I think we're on the right track, for sure. The districts that we have in Brighton, there are many school districts in the town of Brighton, have all taken it very seriously, have all bought in, have all sought input from us, and it seems to be on the right track.
Chris, over at Spencer Port, would you tell parents, hey, this may not be easy, but school's a safe place for your kids?
Statistically, it is. It absolutely is the safest place for your children to be. We work very hard to make sure they're safe during the day. Children are children, and sometimes they don't get along with each other. But we work very hard to make sure that when we identify those issues, we address them right away.
Brandon, over at Penfield, what would you tell parents?
Yeah, I thought Chris was going there. In 2015, the FBI came out with a study that showed that kids are, I think it's 100 times safer at school than they are anywhere else they go in their community. So that's something that it's important to remind people of.
Yeah, and Brandon, 15 seconds, what would
I'd
you tell them?
The same thing. I think the school is still a great place. It's safe, and we've made a lot of great improvements.
Yeah, I think the challenge for journalists continues to be we have to cover the tragedies that should never happen. No child should die in school. No child should be scared of getting shot in school. At the same time, schools continue to be statistically overall a very safe place for kids. So it's a lot of work, and I want to thank our guests, Brandon Fox from Penfield, Brandon Haskell from the Harley School, Christopher Mears from Spencerport, Lieutenant Keith Woodard from the Brighton Police Department. Gentlemen, thank you very much for the conversation this hour.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've got more connections coming up in a moment.